Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone, and I wish you all a good new year. Today, we're going to talk about what we hope will not happen in the upcoming year or two, what is likely to happen, and then what should happen but probably won't. Joining me today to discuss this is our scholar in resident, our executive producer, Richard Gale. Nice to have you with us today, Richard.
Yes, Happy New Year, Gary.
Richard, today we're going to really dissect everything and to do it in segments. We're going to look at our economy, our healthcare system. We're going to look at our energy system. We're going to look at the Middle East. And since you have a very extensive background understanding the different religious groups, the Sunni, the Shia, the way that they've interplayed throughout history, including the impact of the French in Algeria and the British throughout hundreds of years, and how all that set the stage for what we're actually seeing today, and what is the likely outcome of the conflicts in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. And are there any lessons we can learn from the people who are in power now, who are in power at 9/11 in different groups, and what we call leave-behinds, meaning administration can hire up to about 1,700 people who are there to stay behind so the person's legacy and policies continue. It also gives them a feedback of what's happening, so they're always in the loop. All former presidents always are kept abreast because of all the people that they appointed. So we're going to look at all this. We're going to begin by looking at the economies. Now, I say economies because there is not one world economy. There's not one European economy. There's not one American economy. You have the super rich, the uber rich, people who are the billionaires. Not a lot of them, but they have a lot of power and an unusual amount, a disproportionate amount of power. These are not the brightest people in the world either. Please understand that you should not defer to someone who's rich and famous, a celebrity in their field, simply because they are successful. Don't allow them to make choices for you, and frequently that's what we do. We kind of defer up always to those who have power, that if they're powerful, they must have earned it, and who are we to judge them? Well, we should start judging people. I'm going to share some facts from Economic Collapse that we don't think about. Now, these are pieces of the puzzle, and sometimes we only look at a cataclysmic event, the total collapse of a system. Then we say, how did that just happen? What should I do about it? It never happens that way. Your body just doesn't stop because you were healthy and then you weren't. It takes decades of making unhealthy choices till finally there is a breakdown and a collapse. At the point of collapse, you may have a heart attack, diabetes, a cancer, dementia, memory loss, an infection, but it didn't happen all at once. And we only treat the symptoms that we see manifest there and not the underlying cause. So let's look at some of the things that really concern us. On the economy, this year the middle class continues to deteriorate more. I see in the upcoming year more Americans than ever finding themselves living in poverty, and the debt bubble that we're living in will expand substantially. The exact same pattern that immediately preceded the financial crisis 2008 is happening right now, and trillions of dollars of stock market wealth has already been wiped out globally, and some of the largest economies on the planet, such as Brazil and Canada and India and China and Russia, are in deep recessions. And when you look at the cold, hard numbers, they tell a completely different story than what we've been led to believe are optimistic figures. The facts are that from this day forward for the next year, I see us getting to a situation where we're going to bypass a recession and go directly into a major depression for not the rich and the uber class, not the professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, professors, CPAs, architects. Those individuals will always be able to eke out a living. They may have to restrict some of their spending, and they will have less disposable income, but they're not going to suffer. Those who are living in gated communities, who have no debt and have savings and a portfolio of cash, gold, silver, they'll do fine, depending upon where they live. The people who are going to get creamed are the working middle class, the poor working middle class, and the poor class and senior citizens, and young people. Now, you add those up, that's 270 million Americans. So about 55 million Americans will do just fine, but 270 million Americans are going to get slammed. But we won't see them. You see, therein is where we must pull back and ask, am I in the right place right now in order to see the problems we're faced with? Well, it depends upon where you live. It depends upon what your media accesses are. It depends upon your connections and how you network. We, at the Progressive Radio Network, we're being fed information daily, 24/7, from all over the world. So we have a chance to see thousands of articles per week. We decide which of those are relevant, and we post them on health, on ecological issues, etc. So we take only that which we feel is verifiable and legitimate and fair and objective, but it gives us a chance to see far more pieces. The average person doesn't do that homework. They go to one primary source, and that's it. If their source of truth is Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, whoever it may be, that's it. So whatever that person's perspective, that becomes their reality. So therefore, if you're not looking, as I have, at poverty, which led to the multi-award-winning film Poverty, Inc., which, by the way, you can go to our website and see the trailer and the 50 different awards we won this year for it, then if you're not down in Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, much of Florida, Georgia, if you're not out in the Plain States, if you're not up in the Pacific Northwest, you're not going to see dire poverty as you would had you been there. We went to Camden, New Jersey. That's abject poverty. Some people living on under $2 a day. So it depends upon how you're looking at the problem, how much you allowed yourself to experience. These days, most Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. At this point, 62% of all Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings account. And 21% of all Americans don't even have a saving account. Remember that figure. 21% of all Americans don't have any savings whatsoever. So anything happens, environmental disaster, losing their work, being sick, then they're wiped out. The lack of savings is especially dramatic when you look at America and its younger population, and especially those under 55. Incredibly, fewer than 10% of all millennials and only 16% of those belonging to Generation X have $10,000 or more saved up. So if there's a disaster in their life or they go through a hardship, then that means that 90% of them will have no way of coping. They will have to be relying upon friends, family, because there's nothing else out there for them. And of the 10% that have $10,000, well, how long does $10,000 last if you have severe medical bills or you have no other source of income? You'll burn through that in a matter of months. 43% of all American households spend more money than they make each month. That's 43%. For the first time ever, middle-class Americans now make up a minority of the population. Now, back when I was growing up in 1971, 61% of all Americans lived in middle-class and financially secure households. We weren't rich, but we had no debt, and we had food on the table, roof over our heads, we had clothes, and we went to good public schools. Not now. According to the Pew Research Center, the median income of middle-class households declined by 4% from 2000 to 2014. The Pew Research Center also found that median wealth for middle-class households dropped by an astonishing 28% from 2001 to 2013. Now, mind you, there's a difference between median income and median wealth. Income is how much you earn. The wealth is the value of your house, for example, or anything you possess. So there, the bottom dropped out. In 1970, the middle class took home approximately 62% of all income in America. Today, it's 43%. According to the Social Security Administration, 51%, that's half of all American workers, make less than $30,000 a year. And that's for a family of four. So try living on that and paying all your bills and mortgage or rent and food and clothing and school and medical and travel. It can't be done, hence debt. For the poorest 20% of all Americans, median household wealth declined from a negative $905 in 2000 to today. 20% of Americans at the bottom end are $6,021 in the hole. And they have nothing. So they have nothing. They have no wealth. They have no cash. They have no savings. They have nothing. And they still, on top of that, have $6,029 in debt. At this point, the U.S. only ranks 19th in the world when it comes to median wealth per adult, and traditionally entrepreneurship has been one of the major engines that has fueled the growth in the middle class in the United States. But today, the level of entrepreneurship, small businesses, is at an all-time low. In fact, a friend just sent me a magazine of the 21 well-established, long-established businesses, some over 40 years on the Upper West Side. We're only talking about the Upper West Side that closed their doors in the past 12 months. Why? High rents. Who's their advocate? They have none. How does the state or the city protect them? They don't. Do they have to pay the landlord's real estate tax? Yes. That's not fair. No, but they didn't have the lobbying power and the political war chest to buy the legislature in the corrupt people in Albany to get that done. So as a result, New York City becomes one of the most difficult places on the planet to open a small business. And all you see now are empty places and being taken over by mall stores, banks, and drug stores. And that's unfortunate. For each of the past 6 years, more businesses have closed in the United States than have opened. Prior to 2008, this had never happened before in the entire U.S. history. So when those people say that we're for the private working business people, no, they are not. They are not. Because if they were, they would have given zero interest loans, the same they gave to the big banks, and they would have given a provision that for every $1 million we give you in a loan, you have to hire one employee at a living wage plus health insurance so that you put more money back into your local economy. That would have been responsible and reasonable. If you gave them a year before they repaid the debt, then we would have had some really good small businesses hiring multiple people to work and have a chance of succeeding. We didn't give a nickel. We gave $21 trillion to the people on Wall Street, and we shouldn't have given them a nickel. If you have no debt, but you only have $10 to your name, that's it. You don't have any bills, but you don't have $10, that gives you a greater net worth than 25% of all Americans. That's almost 90 million people, 90 million. With $10 and no debt, you have more than they do. An astounding 48.8% of all 24-5-year-olds Americans still live at home with their parents. It's almost 50%. And according to the U.S. Census Bureau, 49% of all Americans now live in a home that receives money from the government each month. And 47 million Americans are living in dire poverty. In 2007, one out of every eight children in America was on food stamps. Today, that number is one out of every five. According to the latest report, $2 a day, living on almost nothing in America, there are 1.5 million ultra-poor households in the United States that live on less than $2 a day. That number has doubled since 1996. 46 million Americans use food banks each year. They start lining up in the morning at 6:30. I've seen them many times when I'm coming back from my run. You'll have an entire block, I mean an entire whole block, lined with people just waiting. And no matter what the weather, raining, snow, boiling hot, it doesn't matter. They have to be there. Why? Because the food banks don't have enough food for the people who need it. The number of homeless children in the United States has increased by 60% over the last 6 years. According to Poverty USA, 1.6 million American children sleep in a homeless shelter. That's 1.6 million children. Children should not be sleeping in shelters. This reminds me of Dicksonian England. Now, if you can believe it, more than half of all students in our public schools are poor enough to qualify for food lunch subsidies. When it comes to child poverty, the United States ranks 36th out of 41 wealthy nations. That's according to UNICEF. An astounding 45% of all African American children in the United States live in areas of concentrated poverty. 40.9% of all children in the United States are being raised by a single parent living in poverty. There are 7.9 million working-age Americans that are officially unemployed right now, but there's 94.4 additional million, that's almost 95 million, working-age Americans that are considered to be not in the labor force. When you add those two numbers together, ready for this? 102.3 million working-age Americans who do not have a job right now. Now, think of that. Let's just stop for a moment and ponder this. We're told things are great. 5.1% unemployment rate? How good is that? Well, that's not true, and everyone knows it. You have nearly almost 27% of the entire adult population of America unemployed, and you have over half of all adults unemployed, the total population versus the adult population. When you have 100 million unemployed Americans, how long before those 100 million who can't get a job or don't have a job before they start to protest? Sooner or later, it will happen. Back in 1950, more than 80% of all men in the United States had jobs. Not today. Now, here's some figures, my final figures on this. The labor force participation rate for men has plunged to the lowest level ever recorded. So fewer men as a percentage of the population are working than ever before in our history. Yeah, and the inventory to sales ratio has risen to the highest level since the great last recession. That means there is a lot of unsold inventory that's just sitting around and not selling. Well, what about the people who made those items? They're not going to have the same reordering. Therefore, their plants are going to be shut down. Their shops are going to be shut down. They're not going to have that income. So when you have a glut, an overabundance of inventory, and people are not going to sell any order anymore until that's sold, there's a rippling effect clear across the spectrum. The ISM Manufacturing Index has fallen for 5 months in a row. Orders for core durable goods have fallen for 10 months in a row. And since March, the amount of small stuff and big stuff shipped by truck, rail, and air inside the United States has been falling every single month on a year-in, year-over basis. Walmart is projecting that its earnings may fall by as much as 12% during the first part of this year. And corporate debt defaults, meaning corporations that are going out of business, and I mentioned this on a previous program, and there are thousands of these corporations with millions total of employees, over 6 million employees, they're defaulting. They got cheap money, they went into debt, now their economies are affected, and they're closing down, cutting back, going broke. By the way, our holiday sales have gone negative for the first time since the last recession. And the velocity of money in the U.S. has dropped to the lowest level ever recorded. Not even during the depths of the last recession was it this low. And Barack Obama promised that his program would result in a decline in health insurance premiums by as much as $2,500 a year less. And people bought that. The reality is the average family premiums have increased by a total of $4,865. So not only was it a lie, but you've burdened people with a family with a debt, when they didn't have the savings. Today, the average household that has at least one credit card, $15,950 in credit card debt. So you don't know when someone drives up in a car, they're making their car payments on a credit card or their house payments. And they might have 5 or 10 different credit cards. It's called kiting. You pay one credit card bill with another credit card. Then you pay that bill with another credit card. You don't have any more money. What you're doing is you're just getting some delays. And a lot of people are just surviving that way. But the debt is not going away. The number of auto loans that exceed 72 months have hit an all-time high of 29.5%. And there has been nearly 8 million homes lost to foreclosure since the ownership rate peaked in 2004. Four people per home, you're dealing with 32 million Americans don't have a home. They're couch surfing or staying with people, and yet we say we don't have a homeless crisis in America. What do you call 32 million people that don't have a home? I would say that that is a pandemic, and yet we won't talk about it. One very disturbing study found that approximately 41% of all working-age Americans either currently have medical bill problems or are paying off medical debt. And collection agencies seek to collect unpaid medical bills from about 30 million Americans each year. So 30 million Americans are deep in debt, and they're the ones who get those harassing calls. And also, a total amount of student loan debt in the United States has risen to a whopping $1.2 trillion. And that's more than doubled over the past decade. And right now, there's approximately 40 million Americans that are paying off student debt. And for many of them, they will keep making those payments until they're dead. That's how long those debts will last. So when you do the math, the federal government is stealing more than $100 million from future generations every single hour of every single day. So that's just an overview. So what I'm showing is that for an awful lot of people that we don't see, may not know, or maybe and don't know the extent of their crisis, we have provided no reasonable solutions. You do not bring banks in. You do not form another committee. You do not make another law, because all of it is written by lobbyists for the very people who are perpetrating this. The only honest solution is simple. If you want to save America's economy, then forgive debt. Forgive all interest debt, 100%, credit cards, mortgages, forgive it all. Forgive all student debt, and then allow no more foreclosures. Keep a person in their home, but bring a payment each month of 15% of their disposable income. Therefore, if their disposable income is $100, then you would get $15 a month. But this way, people stay in their home, which keeps the value of their neighborhood, helps them, and we don't have all this homelessness and these homes being torn to pieces and made into crack houses. It's just a humane thing to do. Remember, we've already done this, but we did it not to John and Elizabeth's home in Newark. We did it to the home of the Rockefellers. We did it to Chase Manhattan. We did it to Citicorp. We did it to Bank America. We did it to Countrywide. All these other banks, their homes, we saved with $21 trillion. So if we could give all those people quantitative easing, give them mass amounts of money, we sure have the capacity to erase this debt. And after all, that debt is owed to either the federal government or to banks that create that debt out of thin air to begin with. They have no assets to back it up. Also, we could ban all trading in derivatives. We could put a tax on all stock transactions of 1%. So every single algorithm trade, any trade at all, 1% of that goes into a general trust, which is not controlled by the government, but an outside group of individuals who have deep backgrounds and working for community projects, and that money would be used to de-ghettoize America from the inside of the ghetto out, and to put into each of the American cities and communities things they need. They need drug counseling. They need health counseling. They need tutoring and special skills needs to educate people on how to have a trade. We need a rebirth and resurgence of trades. We need to also eliminate all of our taxes, wipe everything out, close down the IRS, send those criminals home in their place, have one flat corporate tax of 15%. That's a very small amount, but there's no way you cannot pay it. If you don't pay it, your corporation's taken away from you and sold, and all the people held legally liable, a criminal offense. Now, you do that, you take away the charter of a corporation, then Microsoft and General Motors, everyone would have to pay 15%. No more offshoring. You give a one-time forgiveness and amnesty, and they're holding $31 trillion in profits they should have brought to the United States and paid their tax on. But no rich people and no major corporations are ever affected by the tax because they have hired people to get around them. So our whole tax code is just one giant mess, and the supporters of it are simply delusional or extremely ill-informed. If you have one tax that everyone pays and you eliminate receipts, you eliminate deductions, you eliminate all that goes away, and you get to keep 85%, that would be great. And therefore, we would actually have taxes that could be used. But you could not use any of that for the military-industrial complex or the national medical-industrial complex or the national resource complex, because all that goes to companies that pollute the environment, pollute our bodies, and pollute the entire educational system. Just an idea. Also, be aware of what I feel is coming, a cashless society. It is already happening in Sweden. 95% of all retail sales in Sweden are cashless, and the government of Denmark is also stating its goals to eradicate cash. I think it's a terrible idea, because think of it this way. When you have the only capacity to buy something is if you have a card and all your metrics are on that card, your DNA is on that card, your whole history is on that card. So let's just say that you also were on a government watch list because you were an environmental activist. You protested GMOs, or you protested lack of freedom of speech. Well, there are millions of Americans who are on watch lists now because they have made a protest statement. Now, we're supposed to be protected, but indeed we're not, because the consequences are they're building cases against people. So now they could stop that card from being active. You want to go on a plane? You can't get on. You want to buy food? You can't buy food. You want to get a cab? You can't buy a cab ride. You want to go into a hotel? Oh, rejected. Think of what they would do if they took away cash and then they decided to target you because of what you've done or said. That's the danger. Do not trust the government ever for anything, ever. It is incapable of ever being honest about anything. And also, if we really care about something, we would start the process of having citizen oversight committees of responsible people who have a long, deep history of social issues, and then deconstruct these bureaucracies to the size necessary to function and serve to either to protect or to enhance the quality of our lives and everything else. Let them go out and get a legitimate job, because these bureaucracies have become massive cancers. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the energy commissions, the FDA, the CDC, U.S. Public Health Service, the National Department of Education, all of these are just massively corrupt, inept, inefficient, and oversized bureaucracies, and we pay for it. So you can't have it both ways. You can't complain about something and then not be coming up with a positive solution. I just say bring it down to the size that it can be controlled, and then abolish all of the agencies that oversee security and destroy all files they've collected on citizens, and open up all the prisons and let every single person for a drug crime out, and then expunge their records so they can start fresh. And then close down private prisons and stop privatizing any of our public resources. And then take all money out of all elections so that you have a three-month election cycle. It's by lottery. You have a chance to share your points of view on all issues. You have a chance to randomly, by pure lottery, decide who you're going to debate with. And everyone has a chance then. Anyone who wants to run for office will have the same chance as anyone else. Money won't get you a place on a ticket and won't put you in an office you're unqualified for. And that way you make it illegal for any money from any group to come in to favor one group over another. So you eliminate that. You overturn Citizens United. And then you make sure that any corporation that knowingly, and here's the key, knowingly commits a crime, creates a defective product knowing it did so, everyone involved in that process, from the scientists, the lawyers, the board members, they all would be brought up on criminal charges, and the charter for their company would be revoked, and therefore everyone working for that company would have to go find another job. If you put people in prison who break the law and get away with it because they can pay a fine, but if you don't allow them to pay a fine, you have them go do hard jail time, and you make their corporations responsible, the key is take away the charter. But to do that, you have to ban lobbying, because lobbying is the is a disease in our society. And also, reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. That's crucial. And now, one of the things they're doing worldwide, they're de-dollarizing all across the globe. This is the latest from Sonic Crow News, Timothy Guzman. Quote, the threat of war against Iran is not just about its natural resources, strategic control, and supposedly to protect Israel. It's also about the U.S. dollar being used for its oil trades. Iran is moving forward to replace U.S. dollars for its foreign trade with Russia in reals and Russian rubles. This past January, Iran made a significant move by stopping mutual settlements in dollars with foreign countries. So what's happening in Russia, in China, in India, in Brazil, in other countries, and now in Iran, they want to trade with one another in their own currencies, and all of them have something in common. They're backed by gold. That means that now the dollar is extremely powerful, but that's only because all of the currencies are so susceptible. I predict that within the next 12 to 24 months, with China starting to strengthen itself by having more of its own citizens, buy more of its own products, and regenerating its own industries, closing those that are inefficient or polluting, and now they have to deal with environmental issues because they're so polluted, so many people are dying because of it, and their country's such a mess, that they will then be the strongest new or third currency. That means that the dollar will not maintain its power as a reserve currency as it has in the past. I see the entire European Union imploding. I see countries such as Greece throwing out their corrupt government and going off the euro, taking a big hit, defaulting, and going back to the original currency and reestablishing trade relations with countries that will support them, Russia, India, China, and other countries. They will go through a rough time, but so did Argentina, and it did it. Iceland did it, and it will do it. You can also look at Spain. Spain is a major basket case financially. The youth unemployment rate in Spain is over 50%. So as a result, bright young Spanish kids are leaving, going to other countries. So they have enormous brain drain. So the sooner that European Union is dissolved, and it will be for a lot of countries, the better it will be. And Ireland also will also, I believe, say enough from its corrupt politicians and its bankers and do the same thing. So I see a lot going on. So it'll be almost an illusion. The dollar is powerful. The dollar is strong. The dollar is secure. Invest in American dollars. Invest in American real estate. And the money is going to pour into American speculative real estate. But that's because in their own countries, there's going to be a massive escape of cash and resources, further weakening their country. And for a time, it will seem like the wealthy and powerful in the United States will benefit, but the average person will not. And this will be a giant bubble, and it will implode. Those are some thoughts on the economy. I believe that people should be learning trades. I believe they should get out of what they're in if it's not supporting them and will continue to support them. And I believe that they should also start to look at their environment. Because what if you have a job and you have a nice quality of life, but you're living in Colorado or Oklahoma, where there's lots of earthquakes, or California, where there's dryness and it's going to get bone dry. And now not only is it bone dry, but the ground is sinking because so much has been pumped out of gas, oil, and water that as much as 18 inches have gone down. And that's going to cause bridges to collapse or become unusable, and gas mains to burst. And right now there's a burst, there is a gas leak in California that they're trying to cap, which is extraordinarily dangerous and unhealthy for people there, and it barely makes the news. And that's far worse than the Gulf War spill. And that's one of the problems when you are engaged in the business these energy companies are. So I see the environment being the big 1,000-pound gorilla in the room. I see the environment right now as we speak. England's being hit, the north of England in particular, with the worst storms in its recorded history, as is Wales and Scotland. Iceland just had the worst rainstorm in its history. At this time of year, they shouldn't have any rainstorm, and that's because the Arctic is 50 degrees warmer than what it has ever been. 50 degrees is above freezing today. And that causes all this warm air to float down. It's got all this water in it, and it's dropping tons of water. As a result, a bridge went out today. Now, really, when you have a bridge go out, and this is a substantial bridge, that tells you that the entire structures are going to go. Now, mind you, you have flooding in villages that have never been flooded in their history. This is the new beginning. So these people are going to end up with mold. They're going to end up with dry rot. They're going to end up with an inability to go to back in there and do business normally. And just like Katrina caused massive mold and destruction down in the French Quarter in New Orleans, and it only went up about several inches, not several feet, in the French Quarter because it was a little more elevated. But two years later, the mold was still a factor. So you have old homes to begin with, and thousands upon tens of thousands of homes are going to have to be gutted and redone, or they're going to be filled with black mold, causing people to get very sick and be unsaleable. But now a person has to look ahead and say, gee whiz, is this going to continue? Oh yeah, this is just the beginning. You got off easy. How did I get off easy? There was 8 feet of water in my house. All the furnishings were destroyed, paintings were destroyed, everything was destroyed. Well, that's the new beginning. And you're going to see this across every place now. Today, the Mississippi is flooding. The Ohio River is flooding. The Kanawha River is flooding. Six rivers in America are way above their flood levels. And hundreds of thousands of people are affected. But also nature is taking seeds out of the ground. They're destroying seeds. The soil has a very interesting composition. And you start bringing all this other debris onto that farmland, it's going to disrupt these cycles. Also with heating in California in the breadbasket, clear over to Kansas and Indiana, Illinois, and you start bringing hot weather, seeds don't germinate. You either have too much water, that will rot out the roots, root rot, or it's too dry, and they die. So now, historically, easy-to-grow foods are going to be very difficult to grow, and we're going to have far less. Plus, we've destroyed 50% of all of our beehive with beehive collapse from neonicotinoids. So now you're going to have 30% less food because of pollination. You're going to have 30% less food because of environmental devastation. So the rich will be able to buy food. They always will. It's just a cost of living to them, and they've got it. But what if you're a person that doesn't have that extra cost of living built in? You're going to have less variety of foods, and we're going to see a whole nation struggling with hyperinflation on basic foodstuffs, where milk could double and other things people normally eat will double in price. That's the cost of the environment. Also, the environment, you're going to see more tornadoes, hurricanes, typhoons, earthquakes, volcano, and solar flare eruptions than ever before in our recorded history, going back 10,000 years. You're going to see some really bad things happen. There was a tornado just a week ago in Dallas. Killed at least 11 people, possibly more. Destroyed all those homes. Never happened there before. And never this late in the year. But it did. So we're having more unique and devastating environmental impacts. So this is what we can expect. This is the new normal. Now imagine that before your standard of living was fine, quality of your life was fine. Now it's not. In fact, all those millions of people living in gated communities where they've got golf courses and lakes, that's history. If I were you, unless you're in a place that has got a lot of rain and no problem about water, I would get out, because it's going to be a day when you're not going to be able to get out. You're going to be the last person, because no one's going to buy anything that can't have water. There's no purpose. The aesthetics would go right down the tube. People lose 90% of the investment, and that means the states are going to lose their money. After all, how does the state pay for its bureaucracies and its repair and servicing of its infrastructure? It does so with your tax dollars. What's the tax dollar based upon? The value of your property. So in some places, now I'll tell you how screwy this is. You talk about really, really uninformed people, either intentionally uninformed, what I call the intentional ignorance, or they're just indifferent. The Keys are going to be flooded. They are now, without the rain. That means some streets have 18 inches of water, and that means there's a breeding ground for mosquitoes. The smell and stench in the air is overwhelming. Key Largo is a good example. For 100 years, Key Largo was the go-to place. Not now, and yet people are still buying there. These are people who think, oh, this is only temporary. Oh, this is only one time. No, this is the future. So the Keys, I would, if I lived there, I would sell. All up and down my East Coast, I would sell. Because sooner or later, you're going to get wiped, and then you're going to think, well, maybe I should have listened. In states that are not sustainable for the future, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Kansas, 90% of Texas, 80% of California, Utah, Nevada. These are states that you're going to be hit with multiple environmental crises. So the idea is start looking now at the other states that don't have the problems, and therefore select the places that you could sustain quality of life. There's always progressive communities, and where you have all your services, educational services, and a lot of stuff can be done from home today that couldn't have been done in the past. So you're more flexible and fluid than before, and get out of debt. If there's one overriding message, tear up your credit cards, pay off your bills, and get out of debt. And you'll see why in the upcoming year. Because the 2008 recession, that will be not happening again. We're going to get hit with a full depression, not a recession, because the bubbles that were there did not fully deflate, and new bubbles came in and took their place, because speculators and vulture capitalists made sure that we were re-enticed to go buy a home again or reinvest again, and we shouldn't have. Richard Gale, over to you.
Yes, Gary. You want to tackle some of the Middle East issues?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things we often think about when we're trying to understand the geopolitics, just trying to make sense of our foreign policy and put it in perspective with all the nations that we interfere with around the world, particularly the Middle East, is we often think in terms of the money interest, but rather it's a much larger set of interests. The U.S. doesn't really make friends. We don't have friends. What we have are interests. And especially this kind of applies when we're dealing with those developing countries. We've seen throughout the course of America's history where at one time, the U.S. will talk with other governments. They're called our allies. But really, there's a shared interest. And then the next day when that government, or there's a change of that government, and those interests are pulled away from the U.S., then they become our enemies. And in those cases, then a regime change is called for to install some kind of a despotic dictator or a change of government that will then, provide America with those interests it has in that country. And we've seen this with Gaddafi in Libya. you know, Gaddafi was really acting on behalf of other African nations, wanting them to trade in their own currencies, kind of unite different nation, African nations into an economic bloc. All of these were against the U.S. interests and the interests of the international banking industry and the multinational financiers. So Gaddafi had to go. We saw, well, what's going on with Chavez, prior to with Chavez and now Maduro in Venezuela. Same issue. They wanted to get off the dollar and the trading of their oil. Chavez was very influential in uniting a lot of the kind of social interests and national interests throughout Latin America. And we've been trying to stage a coup and a regime change there. And we also saw it just more recently, you know, with Obama, with Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine. You know, Yanukovych did not want to go along with the expansion of NATO. He was opposed to the IMF demands that were being made on the loan he was trying to seek that would require that the country, employ austerity measures on the population and begin privatizing its resources to Western countries. And so Yanukovych had to go, you know, and Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, made sure that happened. What was one of the first things that happened right as soon as this this kind of radical right-wing government took over was one of the first things they did was the Ukraine being one of the breadbaskets of Eastern Europe, that land was privatized and handed over to Monsanto and Cargill. This was something that, you know, Yanukovych was trying to prevent all along. So I think in understanding all of our geopolitical and intrigues and what's going on in Syria and trying to make sense of why we are such big supporters of Israel and Saudi Arabia, we have to go back, and it's this issue that these aren't necessarily friends. It's that they're friends because they have interests that we are interested in. Want to look focus a little bit on Israel here?
Yes.
There's so many different issues. You know, I think with Israel and to try to make sense, well, we should state that today in the Wall Street Journal, there was a very, very important scoop that came up. And that was, and this kind of might shift a lot of our thinking, and we don't know how this is going to play out, but this is just today. But Obama's NSA was released, has been spying on Netanyahu and his cabinet, wiretapping, particularly during all the dealings with the Iran deal. And a lot of this, they were also, Obama was also spying on those Jewish groups and lobbying groups that were trying to influence the primarily Republican congressional leaders and Republican groups, you know, for the talking points to go against the Iran deal. So I think this is a very interesting development because it kind of shows that there is somewhat of a, you know, looking at Netanyahu as kind of the Trump of Israeli politics. The main difference is that he sits on the king's throne, whereas Trump doesn't yet. And but there is a certainly going to be a shift that's, I think it's going to be very interesting in our relationships with Israel in the future, and our shaping our relationships with the Iran. There are many within the U.S. Military complex that have been speaking out that we should be looking at Iran as an ally, not as an enemy. And so there's a great deal of division. Of course, the Europeans are favor the Iran deal much more, except for the Brits. And a lot of this goes back to this long history that Europe has had in the Middle East that has set a precedent for the way we act in these same regions right now. And, you know, England and France were both, they kind of set up the framing of the various conflicting parties and groups in the Middle East back in, after World War One and the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire. In the case of of Palestine, what you had was a British colonial power that was present, and it intentionally played off both the Jews and the Muslim Palestinians in the region, promising both of them that they could have separately self-determination. That was the way the British played, the card they played. It was called the British Mandate, and this goes back to the Balfour Agreement in 1917, which was the intention to establish a Jewish state. And even back then, the Brits kind of framed it in the language a Jewish state in biblical Palestine, something that the GOP and the radical Christian right in America today will still play on that symbolism. In France, and what we see happening, because France was responsible for what would take place in Syria and Lebanon following the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. And this was a very, very different situation that we see playing out right now. When the Ottoman Empire disappeared, Syria was a loose amalgamation of separate states. And each of these states had, there was a major majority. They didn't interfere with each other. Each had a majority group. In the region of Aleppo, it was mostly Sunni. Along the coastal line is the Shiite Alawite sect, which that Bashar Assad is a member of. What the French were attempting to do was to unite all these little separate provincial groups. And in so uniting, when you think of it, they actually created a situation that could only bring further sectarian strife, given that, well, this maybe in this particular region, it was more under the control of the Druze or the Kurds. There were greater minerals or resources, or in the Aleppo region where there was more fertile land for agriculture, you know, the benefits of being along the coastal line that the Shiite Alawites had. So then once unifying this, the French attempt to unify this, they then had to bring all these factions and sectarian interests under a single umbrella to try to find agreement. And what happens when you have a situation like that? Well, you end up with majority groups and minority groups. You have one group, feeling that the other group has more of the resources and land. And so this kind of explosion that we're seeing now of Sunni interests in Syria can go back directly to when Syria was in, or the French were in Syria. And to Assad's credit, he, by implementing a secular government, he was able to put water on all these different conflicting interests through the region. So That's, I think, an interesting point that we can trace back many of the problems that we're seeing in Syria today, going back to what the French had done. And you don't often hear that. This is something you commentators and historians, when we look, you don't even read about this when we look at what's going on with ISIS and all today.
Richard, let me share an overview here. When we look at ISIS today, we have to take responsibility that we created the circumstances that allowed ISIS to be created. Had we not gone into Iraq, had we not gone into Libya, had we not gone into Afghanistan, and allowed through the historical processes of resolution, as both the Arabs have done for 1,000 years, and the Persians as well, to allow them in their own ways to interpret their own reality. They have a different religious set of beliefs. They have different cultural beliefs. They have a different view of the family and individuals and power. And yet we want to take in one template, moniker it, freedom and truth and democracy, and stamp it on them, and therefore go through regime change. Well, it didn't work and hasn't worked anywhere. It didn't work in Vietnam, didn't work in Yugoslavia, didn't work in Chile. It didn't work in Argentina. It didn't work in Colombia. So it doesn't matter where we try it, it doesn't work. And but the neocons keep fueling it because behind every war, every incursion, there's a massive amount of private contractors that get billions of dollars, trillions collectively over these decades. So here we have Saudi Arabia, the two biggest players in the Middle East right now, set Israel aside for a moment, is Saudi Arabia and Turkey. Both are known and proven to be the number one and number two harbors of terrorists, funders of terrorists, suppliers of weapons of terrorism, giving safe haven to terrorism, and we know that. So how do you think that's going to play if the American people ever allow themselves to know the truth that we, the United States, are providing the cover for 12,000 vehicles filled with oil that was stolen from Syria and Iraq to go into Turkey to be then processed and sold on the black market by the president of Turkey's family? And we didn't take out a single one of those trucks in 14 months. Russia comes in, says we're going to stop ISIS, and does. They stop cutting off their $1 to $4 million a day income from oil. We then continue to sell arms to these people because it's profitable. We're the number one arms purveyor in the world. So at the end of the day, here's what I predict. I predict that in Yemen, the Yemenis will fight back and cause a stalemate. They will then not forget that the Saudis and now the Kuwaitis and Qatar and others are coming in and bombing them, killing innocent people, causing 16 million people to be suffering from food and water privations, thousands dead, whole areas completely decimated and with depleted uranium bombs, our bombs that we sold Saudi Arabia, from our jets that we sold Saudi Arabia, and our intelligence that we gave Saudi Arabia, and our boots on the ground as far as CIA operatives guiding all this. Those people are not going to allow this. I see the following. I see major attacks against Saudi oil refineries, Kuwaiti oil refineries, Turkish infrastructure by the people who have been attacked by them. I see this conflict going on for a long time, and it's only when there's been so much pain that the Saudis finally have burned through all their money. They started with $900 billion. They thought that would be plenty. Now they're actually borrowing money, and now they're pumping even more oil in a glutted market, so the price is going to go down further. So when they start having their own villages in Saudi Arabia raided, which has happened last week, two villages in Saudi Arabia were raided by the Yemenis and taken over, and now they'll go from there to their oil refineries, then you're going to see that whole area of the world suddenly stop and say, okay, we got to come to some kind of settlement here to stop this. But it's only when Saudi Arabia and Syria start losing economic control of their circumstances that they will use political and theocratic input to say, all right, now let's have some kind of peace. The best thing we could do is to close down the 800-plus military bases around the world that we don't need. We have 53 in Germany. We've had it since the end of World War II. We had 45 in Japan. There's no reason to have any of these bases in any of these places. But they're part of the bureaucracy. Once you create a bureaucracy, it never dies. So I see that sooner or later, the people in the Middle East are going to have to solve their own problems, and it's not going to be through forced regime change because Russia's not going to allow it, Iran's not going to allow it, China's not going to allow it. And when you get Iran, China, and Russia joining together to protect Syria, because Syria never had an actual civil war. That's a myth sold to the American public. This was all about regime change from the British, the French, the Germans, and the Americans. We wanted Assad out, just as like we wanted Saddam Hussein out. We wanted Gaddafi out, and we got him out. Except here, he had allies, or he'd have been out a long time ago, and today, Syria would be a completely failed state, no better than Gaddafi's country, and you might have Turkey being the primary influence along with Saudi Arabia in there, but they would be fighting ISIS right now and even more conflict, more refugees. So we're going to have massive problems there for the next probably 5 years. You'll see probably another 1 to 2 million people dead, and only then will there be a peace. You're going to see thousands more die in Afghanistan. In the end, they'll have a get together, and they will have the Taliban in the new administration. Like it or not, the things that we thought we wanted won't happen. The things they need will happen. So, Richard, thank you for sharing these insights with us. And for all of you listening, we've just touched some of the issues on upcoming programs. I'll give you additional insights, including a commentary between the tension between power and morality, and also what's happening with our national security state and our health. These will be addressed on upcoming programs. Have a nice day, everyone. Look forward to seeing you back on our regular scheduled programming on Monday. Ah.